What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, you rode an elevator this morning.
It's true, I did.
I rode
two.
You rode two elevators?
Mm-hmm, two banks of elevators.
Oh, do explain, because I only rode one.
Ah, well, see, you're coming in off of MARTA.
Right.
And so you're coming in at the ground level, so you only take one bank. But if you drive into our office building, you have to take two different sets of elevators.
Oh, okay.
I had twice the fun.
Twice, huh? See, I took an escalator up from MARTA, and then the elevator up in our building. I could have taken the MARTA elevator, though I think it doubles as a bathroom. So I try to avoid it.
Well, I was about to say, it's part of our public transportation system, right, MARTA?
Right.
And I will confirm that it does smell like urine in the elevator banks.
Now, in this episode, of course, we're going to talk about elevators.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just going to be, we're not just going to focus on the mechanics and all that, though the mechanics are pretty fascinating when you break them down. We're going to get into the psychology of it, the culture of it, elevators of the past, or possible elevators of the future a little bit. But to kick things off here, I want to ask you, and then I'm going to ask myself the same question, name me a fictional elevator or an elevator scene that particularly excited you, and a real-life elevator that you loved and or feared.
Okay, all right. So I debated about this because I was thinking about this. I thought, well, I think that the one that made the most impact on me is probably the elevators from The Shining.
Ooh, yes.
Because blood gushes out of them. But you don't really spend much time in the elevators. So, but just the idea that blood would come gushing from them. And then that thought me to, that got me to thinking about how in a lot of movies, at least, elevators are the scenes for awful things happening.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, there's usually some sort of, I don't know, heist going on, or in Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, there's that. Remember, there's the blood dripping down from the hatch.
I totally forgot about that elevator scene, but that is a great sequence. Terrifying.
Yeah, awful. So I started to think about how that really feeds into sometimes our phobias about elevators, because really, I mean, what is it but just a little metal canister that you seal yourself into? Which leads to, again, fears, because I was thinking about a building called the Westin Peachtree in Atlanta, and it's a very tall building.
Oh, yes, the Westin. This is the one that looks like a big paper towel roll.
Yes.
Ascending into the
sky.
Yeah,
a glass paper towel roll.
Yeah, it has a revolving restaurant at the top.
Which the sundial restaurant.
Us Atlanteans take out of town guests
too. Yeah, because like, woo, look at us. We're moving around as we eat. but the terrifying thing is that their elevator is glass, and it's you're going up on the side, and you see if you're someone like me who has a fear of heights, then obviously you begin to see the landscape unfold in front of you, and you begin to inch up more toward the door.
Yeah,
those are my examples.
Those are some interesting elevators for sure. The ones at the Westin. I tend to really enjoy the ride, but my wife, she just kind of looks at the door and try it. Cause she's not crazy about the glass.
Mm-hmm.
I think. And also she's a little bit claustrophobic in elevators sometimes. So, but we'll discuss the psychology of elevators a little more as we continue. For my own part, the real world elevator that I often think about, I have to go back to my college days in Knoxville, Tennessee, the University of Tennessee. There was a dorm there called Melrose Hall, and I think Melrose Hall is still there. I don't know if it's still a dorm or if it's been incorporated into something else. But when I went there, it was really cool because it was a dorm exclusively for international students and socially introverted people like myself, who upperclassmen who weren't leaving campus to find exciting apartment living, but needed a room to themselves in a dorm.
When you got off the elevator banks, did it say that? Did it say Melrose Hall for the international students and the socially introverted?
But they updated it in recent years because when I went there, the beds were all really short, like left over from World War II. So I had to like sleep with a mattress in a really weird position because it had a footboard, and I'm fairly tall. And there was no air conditioning, so during the summer, you just had to sweat it out or live exclusively at night or go down and sleep in, like, the one or two refrigerated rec rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And it had this ancient elevator. This dorm was not that tall. I think it was two or three floors above ground. But one of the things that made it awesome was that there were two basements. There was a basement where there was just there were offices and dorms. Some people actually lived in the basement. And then there was a sub-basement. And to this day, I wish I'd found a way to visit the sub-basement because I love the idea of there being an extra sub-world down there. And like, what does it consist of? There are no dorms down there, or are there? What kind of strange creatures live down there in the sub-basement of Melrose Hall? I don't know. And it also had a little gate, the old-school gate that you had to pull across.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And the clunky buttons that look like they're part of a furnace or something. So I loved that elevator. I have no idea if they still have it. Maybe they replaced it.
Sure, they upgraded it. Yeah. Probably took out the grate.
It was indeed great, though, in the nice. GREAT sense. Fictional elevators... I always come back to one of my favorite movies, John Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China. In this particular movie, you keep encountering elevators that only go down. And I've always been inspired and fascinated by subworlds and underground spaces and descents. And so these elevators that only go down are always just really fascinating to me. In Big Trouble in Little China, there's a scene where they're taking it down. It ends up the elevator goes into water, and they have to escape and swim out through this kind of watery dungeon hell environment. And then there's another elevator they take straight down, which is plush and looks like a really fancy Chinese restaurant on the inside. And there's a wonderful scene where all the heroes are packed into this little elevator. And you have sort of a cliche elevator scene where, you know, people are just standing there doing nothing kind of awkwardly. But then they're also having all this magic potion that they just consumed. It's kicking in. And so they're beginning to feel kind of magical and invincible. It's a wonderful scene, but you mentioned all the scenes that take place in movies involving elevators. And when you do think about them, the elevator becomes this interesting space from just a storytelling point of view. Because it is a space between. It is a space where you can encapsulate your characters and force them to have a little small talk and maybe, push the plot a little forward. It's a great way to transition between one set and another. And then you get into all the hijinks of climbing out of elevators, climbing on top of them, becoming stuck in an elevator.
Right.
A classic way to do a very limited episode of a TV show. I wonder how, and it's always like a woman giving birth in an elevator. That's another big one that's always happening on TV. So
it is.
Yeah, I think
I've missed that. Wow.
I feel like there's a supercut online on YouTube somewhere of just scenes of women who are pregnant in elevators. So.
I'm not going to check that out. You know, as we're discussing this, this actually reminds me of the movie Inception, which we bring up every once in a while. But there is a great narrative technique, now that I'm thinking about it, of his psyche being in line with an elevator. So when he plunges into his dream world, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, then he descends in the elevator, particularly when he has like very tragic memories that he's revisiting.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, I mean, it turns out that the elevator is a great metaphor for, as you say, the in-between spaces in life. And it's something that we do take for granted, but it is so fascinating to me because, really, you're talking about, I don't know, maybe a 20 to 30 second ride on an elevator, and yet it can sometimes be the most awkward ride. Mm-hmm. And it is one of these great things. It's a microcosm for really how we act in social situations. There's so much going on in just that little span of time. And when you really think about it, I mean, what is an elevator? But it's really a box suspended by ropes and a counterweight. And remember that, you know, for us, it's not a big deal. But if you were in the early 20th century and you were an office worker in one of the beautiful new sparkling skyscrapers, this would be a really weird experience for you. And, you know, you'd have to deal with getting into this metal box that's going to go up this narrow little shaft and what that meant to you psychologically. And I wanted to point out that this is about the time, at least in the 40s, when skyscrapers really became prevalent, that you began to see music being piped into elevators. Because what they're trying to do there is psychologically set you up for this feeling that everything is okay, and they give you the most bland vanilla music to pipe in. So, you know, again, we take that stuff for granted, but if you were someone in that time period, you know, 1900s to 1940s, this would be kind of a weird thing.
And by the way, the Muzak playing in the background there was track two from a 1974 Muzak LP known to collectors as the Blue Album. So, yeah, you don't see Muzak anymore, or at least I haven't encountered Muzak in forever on board an elevator. Now they try different tactics to try and make you... think about something other than the tiny suspended box and a shaft that is your environment.
Yeah, I read somewhere that the Muzak became so associated with elevator rides that they got rid of it because it was just reminding people that they were in an elevator.
Yeah.
So
I mean, you still see it in movies, I think. People still reference that, the idea that, you know, it kind of drives home the awkwardness of an environment where it's like you're standing right next to a total stranger and there's funky music playing, like this, but not real funky music, but like Muzak, which is kind of the uncanny valley of music anyway. This driving home the awkwardness and artificiality of your setting.
I love that. Now I'm thinking about a robot just staring back at me vacantly in the form of music, which really, that is what the old Muzak was like. Okay, so before we go and give you guys a little bit of history of elevators and then go into the psychology, we did want to cover something really important, and that is the door close button.
Yes, the door close button, which I think we've all hit it at least once, probably 10, 20 times in a row. You know, that feeling where that I get when I've arrived on the train, I hurry up the escalator, I walk in through the front door of the building, and then there's an elevator already arrived on the ground floor just waiting for me. So I get inside, and I'm the first person in there. Now, at this point, I want those doors to shut, because if they don't, like, eight people are going to show up, and they're all going to, like, different floors, and we're on the, what floor are we on, the 10th?
Somewhere up there.
Yeah. Well, I don't know why I can't remember that. I push this button every day. I've been reminded that we're on the 15th floor, technically the 14th, because, you know, they skipped the 13th, because that would be unlucky.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, anyway, you know, I rush onto the elevator, and I start pushing that door close button. And it seems to take forever. And I always, I guess in the past, I always just thought, well, you don't want it to be a situation where you just push that button and it slams shut like guillotines, twin guillotines. You know, that would be dangerous. You would need some sort of delay. But it never really occurred to me that the button does not work at all, or at least probably does not work at all.
Yeah, it probably doesn't, because it turns out that buildings that were built, particularly from the 90s and onward, They are not usually keyed so that the door button works. Usually, they are just in case of an emergency. Mm-hmm. So the door close button is really only going to work if you have a key for the elevator.
Right.
So, I just want everybody to know that, because if you've ever been frustrated and said, why won't the door close? And also felt a little bit of a fool and a jerk because, you know, there was a huge amount of people that were stampeding toward you as you were pushing the door close.
And
it's all for naught.
Yeah. And then sometimes, rarely, but occasionally it'll be someone I know out there. And also I'll go to push the door open button.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't work or something. And then I feel like a jerk because they're thinking I was frantically pushing the door close button to leave them on the bottom floor. And people get kind of bent out of shape about their elevator situation. As pointed out in some of the resources we were looking at, including the fabulous article Up and Then Down, The Lies of Elevators by Nick Palmgarten, a 2008 New Yorker article, mm-hmm. which is about 1,000 pages long, of course, since it's a New Yorker article, but it's excellent. It's like a mini novel about the history of the elevator, the culture of the elevator, and one particularly harrowing example of someone trapped in an elevator for, mm-hmm. I believe, 41 hours.
Yeah, we'll mention him in a moment, but you're right, it's set up really great because they take this guy, Nick White, the guy that mm-hmm. was trapped, and they use that as a reference point.
Right. But one of the points that that Palmgarten keeps coming back to is that, and some of the people he interviews keep discussing, is that we hold elevators to this different standard than we do anything else. Like, I take the train to work, and if I have to wait 20 minutes on a train, it's just kind of part of it. It's MARTA, so I just, you know, whatever. It's just going to be a slow ride, and then, I'm next to somebody that's either a stranger or kind of awful. That's just public transportation. No big deal. If there's a delay, all right, this is part of the experience. On an elevator, I expect to wait no more than 30 seconds. I expect to ascend and pretty, hopefully, directly to my floor, which I'm told, again, is the 15th floor. And I don't...
Technically the 14th.
Yeah, and if any of these things get messed up, I get a little bit out of shape about it.
Yeah, and that's what is so interesting when you look at trying to actually engineer a decent set of elevators, and we'll get more into that. But let's talk about the Otis Elevator Company, because this really is the gold standard in the industry.
Yeah, you've all been seeing the word Otis inside your elevators all your life, and I never really thought about it beyond just making a quick reference in my mind to old Andy Griffith episodes, you know, where you had Otis the drunk, and I imagine him on an elevator, and that's kind of the end of it. But they are the elevator company in the United States and one of the major players globally. Most of their work these days isn't even in the United States. They're going
right.
to Asia and the Middle East, and they're advising and installing elevator systems in these magnificent high-rises that everyone freaks out about on the internet. I mean, everyone's always sharing a picture of either the newest skyscraper under construction or the plans for this elaborate skyscraper mm-hmm. that they're going to build in the desert somewhere. And of course, any time you're designing a building like that, any time you're looking to create something like that, elevators are an essential part of it. I mean, without elevators, we would not have skyscrapers, because you need a way for able-bodied people to reach any floor in a pretty short amount of time. And then you also need disabled individuals, mm-hmm. individuals who are not up to multiple. Just for it to make sense at all, you have to have an elevator system.
And it's particularly an interesting business now with the skyscrapers and the tallness of them, because, you know, basic physics will tell you that if you reach beyond 1,000 feet up in cabling for an elevator system, that's about the top of what you can get there, because otherwise your cables will snap. So you've got a bunch of engineers working on this problem, because a lot of these buildings are much higher than that, especially if you look at something like the Burj. So there's some really good meaty problems to work on for engineers and mathematicians. But before we start looking more at the modern systems, let's talk about Elisha Graves Otis. He founded the company, Otis Elevators, in 1853, mm-hmm. when he figured out an operating system that could prevent free falls in passenger elevators, which is always nice.
Yeah, because the basic idea of an elevator is pretty ancient. The basic physics of hauling a box up, I mean, that dates back to the ancient Greeks.
Well, yeah, I read something, too, about the 1st century B.C. Romans would operate lifts using pulleys with humans, animal, and water power.
Right.
So, yeah, it is a very simple process, if you think about it.
But, yeah, it wasn't until we really had the safety features in mind that we could and also the ability to build multiple skyscrapers that it really became a thing.
Yeah. And then in 1948, Otis introduced the automatic elevator system, and that eliminated the need for operators. So no longer did you get into the elevator, at least in most office buildings, and was there an attendant there. Now, that did introduce an element of randomness, because before this, you had someone in the elevator who knew where you were going and knew sort of the traffic patterns of people and would call that out to the operator. So it was easy to anticipate traffic. But when they moved to the automated system, it was a little bit more of, okay, well, nobody knows really what the traffic patterns are anymore, and people had to wait a little bit more.
Yeah, it was apparently in the 1940s where we saw that shift from elevator operators to operator-less elevators, which instantly makes me think of Mad Men.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Do you watch Mad Men?
I've caught it before. I haven't seen all the seasons.
Well, they make a lot of use of the elevators because they work in a high-rise, so there's a lot of room for scenes where individuals encounter each other awkwardly or generally awkwardly in the elevator, but then also some excellent scenes. There's one in particular where Draper goes to take the elevator down and the doors open to just an empty shaft. And it has a lot to do with, I mean, it's thematically with what's going on in the show at that point. But it's a fascinating scene. And likewise, there's generally, I think at least up until now in the show, there's always an elevator operator. So I'm kind of looking forward to the point when the elevator operator is no longer present, because I guess this is kind of an old-fashioned building that they're hanging on to that tradition, and I kind of want to see Draper's face when that goes away.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world.
Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
That's kind of interesting, too, how that dovetails with the changing social ways at that time, because you could kind of think of the attendant as the chaperone.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sort of, I guess you could say, very controlled relationship is flying away during that time, right? You have the 60s, and people are beginning to be freer. So again, here's the elevator as a microcosm of society in which, you know, no longer is a chaperone there, and anything can happen in an elevator.
Right. And now, as we'll discuss a little later, we're in an age where we see that amount of freedom vanishing more and more in the elevator.
Mm-hmm.
We see technology taking over to the point to where we feel just like we're at the whim of whatever mysterious mechanical force is controlling this magic box.
Yeah, and so, and there you go with the door close button, right? That's just an illusion of free will.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite things that I stumbled upon when we were researching this is an old clip from a Candid Camera show. Do you remember that show?
Yeah, this was where they would, you know, kind of a forerunner of reality shows, kind of like, what was the show, Punked, I think, was the MTV thing several years back.
The Ashton Kutcher, yeah.
Yeah, where they would prank people. You know, it's just a prank show. They do, and some of it bordered on what we would now call almost performance art or theater everywhere kind of shenanigans, where you're creating something weird in a public space and then seeing how people react to it.
Yeah, so, I mean, actually, in its purest form, it really is kind of a social experiment, because nobody was doing that before that. And so you had this Candid Camera crew set up basically Confederates, and we've talked about Confederates before. These are people who are in on an experiment or a joke.
Right.
And what they did is they filmed an elevator, a bank of elevators. They had, I don't know, like five different Confederates go into an elevator, and then a person who's not in on it, and go in and observe what's going on. And quickly you could see that people would react accordingly. Like they would feel the pressure of those around them to do the right thing socially. So what I mean is that if five Confederates went in and they all turned around and faced the wall, which is an unusual thing to do in an elevator, the person would look around and then join them.
Right. And in some of these, they would sort of hold out at first, but then they would succumb to the groupthink. And look at the wall. And it's fascinating. Yeah, because there's this sense of, you know, conformity and wanting to look like you know what's going on. Like I've been in, we've all probably been in elevators before where you have a door on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly seem to encounter these in hospitals for some reason. I just because some of the weird floor layouts that are involved. And there is this kind of confusion that takes hold. Which door is going to open? Not only do I need to know which way I'm going, and there's that sort of basic directional survival instinct in your mind, but you also don't want to look like you don't know which door is open. You know, you want to appear in control. You want to feel in control in this thing.
Yeah, you don't want to look like a rube. And that's what's so funny about this Candid Camera clip, because the Confederates continue to turn. Well, turn to the right. And then the guy turns to the right. And then they turn, you know, to the opposite way, to the left, and so on and so forth. Or they all are wearing hats, and they take their hats off, and he takes his hat off. So, again, microcosm of what's going on socially and the pressures that we feel to conform. And it was just a really elegant little social experiment that was conducted by Candid Camera, of all people.
We're talking about the psychology of elevators at this point. So there are a few different factors that are mandatory in discussing our mindset inside of this magic box. The first of which, of course, as we touched on earlier, wait times.
Mm-hmm.
How long is this ride going to take? Because even if you're in there alone, you don't want to be there too long. And and this is actually the sort of thing that elevator strategists and elevator designers are very key to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it varies from culture to culture. But in the United States, 30 seconds. Like, that's as long as anyone is tolerant being on an elevator.
And this is really important. It sounds kind of random, right? 30 seconds, so what's the big deal? But it turns out that office space is far more desirable if they can deliver people in that 30 seconds or less time frame. So you want to have a good office space that can deliver this.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about this is that when you get out of an office situation and more into, say, like an apartment building situation, people are much more forgiving. So you can add another 10 or 15 seconds onto that.
In an apartment building?
In an apartment building.
Hmm. Yeah, because people, they have their personal effects. It's more about life going on and less, this is a job. I need to get where I'm going. I don't
exactly.
have time for your job. It reminds me, though, another college elevator thing was another dorm that I was in was one called North Carrick in the University of Tennessee. And this one was, I think I was on the 10th floor of this particular dorm, and it was awful because we had two elevators serving the entire building, and the wait times were just colossal. Unless you were like, maybe, if it was the middle of the night or something, or some weird time, but the morning hours, afternoon hours, like key traffic times of the mm-hmm. day, it was just a colossal wait. The door would open and it would already be packed, and you end up just taking 10 flights of stairs, in the summer, and just totally exhausting yourself and sweating all over the place just because the elevators were that bad. And like nobody wants to encounter that. Like that just makes,
yeah.
It's just, we have no tolerance for it.
Well, and every once in a while you will encounter an elevator bank like that, right? And mm-hmm. what it's doing is that it's not cross-referencing any of the data that we'll talk about later.
Right.
It's not very sophisticated. It's basically just saying, I'm going to stop at every stop that's going up, load people up, and then I'm going to go back down, and I'm going to stop at every single floor. So it's just sort of a single-function elevator.
Yeah. In the New Yorker article that we were looking at, he interviews a man by the name of James Fortune, who's pretty much the top-class elevator advisor, strategist, designer, gets into all of these questions of, how are we going to lay this out for maximum efficiency?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things he discussed were things that I had never really thought of. Like, for instance, you want to cut down as much as possible on floor-to-floor travel.
Interfloor
travel. Because that,
yeah.
the idea that yeah. some, like even in our building, where mm-hmm. I know that you cannot travel between floors via the staircase because of the lock system. It's set up so that if you want to take the stairs, you better be going to the ground floor. There's mm-hmm. no using it to go in between floors. It's just part of the safety system here. So I'll see individuals who work for a business that occupies two different floors in this building. I'll see them go from one floor to the other. And even though I rationally know that they have no choice but to do that, I still have this really judgmental voice in my head that's like, come on, lazy, take the stairs. What's the matter with you? And I guess it's a holdout from my college days in that awful dorm.
It's funny, in that New Yorker article, I think that the author talks about how that's really infuriating as well, and I believe that his perspective is like, okay, you're going to go get on the Stairmaster for an hour after work, but you won't take the stairs.
Yeah.
Now, of course, not everybody can, has that luxury.
Yeah, you're moving from one floor to the next with a bunch of files or some coffee.
Right, right. Or maybe you have something physically going on that prevents you from
exactly.
doing that. But you're right, mathematicians cannot stand it. They hate that because that is an X factor that they can't account for because they have all these probability scales that they can rely on, mm-hmm. but that's the one thing that will throw them off because how can you account for that?
Yeah, some of the other rules that he goes into, for instance, if you have a hotel and you have a cafeteria or you have a check-in on a second floor, that floor better be accessible via an escalator or likewise for a high traffic subfloor.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, when we were in Minneapolis for the educational talk we gave, I noticed that the bottom three floors were all connected via escalators.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize now that is because they didn't want high traffic between those three floors monopolizing the elevator banks.
That's right. And because they had a very small amount of elevator banks. Right.
It was a pretty small amount for a tall building.
And that's another thing. Architects don't want to cede a lot of square footage to elevators because that's going to decrease the profits on the amount of office space or hotel space that they can rent out. So they have to make it as small of space and as efficient as possible. And they also have to take into account personal space,
yes.
which is tied into culture. We'll talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. How close am I willing to get to the person in the elevator with me?
Yeah. Edward Hall, who pioneered the study of proxemics, called the smallest range less than 18 inches between people intimate distance. Now, this is the point at which you can sense another person's odor and temperature. And the thing is that Americans typically like to be at least 2.3 feet away from one another. So mm-hmm. they don't want to get to the point where they can smell you or feel your body temperature.
Yeah. I mean, even in the United States, you see a certain breakdown between, say, New York City and everywhere else. You know, like if you're dining, say, in a New York restaurant versus elsewhere, like here in Atlanta, you go to a restaurant, you expect to have a certain amount of space between you and the other diners. You expect the table to be a fair distance across. But like, you go into a lot of New York eateries and they're going to be elbows bumping. You're going to be looking down the shirt of the person directly in front of you. There's just a different proximity rule in New York City, than there is in the rest of the country.
Yeah. And it turns out that in, the United States, at least, you can sort of infringe on that 2.3 feet. You can go about 2 feet in with Americans and still be okay with it. You can jam that elevator, and as long as everybody has 2 feet, they're okay with it. But as you say, like, you know, there are different rules in different places. And in Asia, you could double pack that elevator, and people would be fine because they don't have that much of a need for distance.
Right. And you see that elsewhere, like public transportation. You see that in the difference between the Japanese subway system and then public transportation here in the States. How comfortable are people willing to pack? Now, I've certainly been on some MARTA trains before where it's just like sardines in there, but everyone is visibly upset by the situation.
especially in the summertime when the car's air conditioning isn't working. So again, this is pointing more toward cultural norms, right? What works out for each culture. And there's a really great article in the Wall Street Journal, and they have profiled an Otis elevator mathematician, Teresa Christie.
Yes.
And she tries to account for all the different cultural aspects as well as everything else that's involved in getting an elevator to run smoothly. And so she was saying that in a hotel in, say, Mecca in Saudi Arabia, she now has to account for the fact that people are getting ready to pray at least 5 times a day.
Right.
So she has to make sure that those elevator banks can respond to those high traffic times.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a factor that is going to be involved in any of these Middle Eastern high rises that are always, you know, making the news, either in construction or in planning.
And then she was saying that in Japan, there's a psychological element to waiting. So they want to know when their elevator is coming. So in Japan, the light over your perspective elevator lights up, even if it's not there yet. And the author of the Wall Street Journal likened it to a nod of acknowledgement from a busy bartender.
Okay.
Which I thought was great, because if you've ever gone up to the bar and it's completely slammed and you feel that frustration
is nobody noticed I'm not here? Am I not classy enough looking? Is this because of me? And you can get a little stressed out about it. So I can imagine that you get to the elevator banks, you want to know an elevator is coming. And so they're set up to deal with that.
Yeah, so those are just some of the cultural aspects of it. Now, we probably should mention Nick White real quick.
Yes.
This is the guy that was trapped in the elevator in 1999 for 41 hours.
Yes, and his story is covered in various articles across the net, and it serves as kind of the narrative backbone of Palmgarten's 2008 article, which, again, I highly recommend everyone read because it's brilliant. He worked at Business Week, I think it was.
Yeah.
And the elevator system there was a little archaic. I think they had four elevators, or at least there were four on
in the video camera.
The video camera.
Yeah.
So he's at work, and I think he goes down for a smoke, and then he's coming back up.
It's like a Friday evening.
Yeah.
Let's say 5 o'clock or something. I mean, it's later in the evening.
Yeah. So he's going down for the smoke, and what happens?
Well, I think that he was traveling up to the 43rd floor, and he must have made it up to, well, he definitely made it up to the 13th floor, because I believe that's where it stopped. And so he doesn't freak out right away. He starts calling the emergency button.
Yeah, like you do. Again, there's a button there for an emergency, so you push it.
No one, nothing, zero. So the video camera, the security system that you see, the video footage from this is pretty fascinating, because they speed it up over that 41 hours, and you see him pacing, you see him lying down, you see him fiddling with his cigarettes, because at first he wants to be the model employee and not smoke in the elevator, you know, even though he's definitely feeling pretty stressed out at this point, because hours are going by.
Right.
And then he begins to have aural hallucinations. Right? Because
he's hearing things.
I mean, we're talking
we've talked before of this on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You have a limited environment. Our brains need more stimulation than that. So they start overanalyzing everything, and eventually they start interpreting data that isn't actually there.
Right. And, you know, 20 hours pass, 30 hours pass, you know, he's getting dehydrated. He hasn't eaten. Mm-hmm. And of course, the hallucinations are coming on, and he begins to think that this is a tomb, that this is, that he's going to die in this. They're going to open the doors.
Because, he's tried pushing the button. Nothing's happened. He's pried open the doors, and it's just a solid wall. And I think he sees 13 scrawled there.
Yeah.
In, which is also pretty ominous. You know?
That doesn't help. Yeah.
And of course, he's seen enough movies to know that he should try to open that little hatch in the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't, because in real life, surprise, surprise, climbing on top of an elevator is incredibly dangerous. So they do not want you to do it. It's bolted from the outside.
Right.
That's so that if someone needs to get in and help you out, they can, but it prohibits people from potentially killing themselves by climbing on the roof.
Well, because apparently, and it's not going to surprise anybody, but at some point in history, elevator riding became a thing and people did it.
Oh, like elevator surfing, yeah.
Yeah, elevator surfing. And you've got those counterweights going by which can decapitate you. So, yes, for good reason they lock those. It is only for emergency situations. And he's in an emergency situation. He still can't do anything about it. But I feel just bad for this guy because the elevator kind of broke him.
Yeah.
41 hours passes. He gets out. He asks for a beer. He's disoriented.
He doesn't know what day it is. He doesn't really know how long he's been in there totally. And it kind of ruins his life.
Yeah. And this job of 15 years that he held, he's let go from. He's obsessed and angry about it. He doesn't know why people didn't come and find him. Why? Because here's someone who's he just went out for a cigarette break and he wants to know why.
And the video footage is there. Like somebody was sitting there walking by and just did not notice that there was only ever one individual inside of that car, and that sometimes they were laying down for hours at a time. So, you totally sympathize with this man's breakdown because he was really dealt a foul card on this one.
Yeah, and it's funny. I believe it's in that Up and Down article, or one of the articles that we read, at least. It may be another one. But in one of those articles, they talked to him about it. He's like, well, of course I still have to use elevators. Mm-hmm. And yes, I just still tried to distract myself. But I thought about that, you know, when I got into my own elevator bank. You know, you've got the Captivate, at least in our office, we've got the Captivate screen that's trying to distract you from the fact that you're in an elevator.
Which is brilliant, because you get in there, and there's no music, but there's this little TV screen that gives you quick tidbits about the weather, quick headlines, that sort of thing. And it can be a lifesaver if you're stuck on there, not with a complete stranger, but sort of a pseudo-work stranger, like someone you really don't know that well, but you feel obligated to speak to them. And then all you have to do is look up at Captivate, and then it'll give you the weather. And you'll be like, whoa, look, it's raining Saturday. How about that? Or, whew, look at that Olympic headline. You know, instantly you have some sort of nugget that you can probably discuss awkwardly for 30 seconds or less.
Yeah, because, I mean, that again, is the thing about the elevator is psychologically you're going to want to have, the most vanilla conversation. Because on a very primal level, what's happening is that you're all stuffed into this elevator. You have no control. And so what the human thing to do here is to try to go to the spot where you feel non-threatened.
Right.
And really that's what we're talking about here is, I mean, at the end of the day, we're all a bunch of animals anyway. So we're all stuck in this elevator trying to make sure that in that 20 seconds, nothing bad is going to happen. Therefore, the weather is fine. You can talk about that if you must talk.
Yeah. And then we go home in the evening and watch movies and TV shows about bad things happening in elevators because we can't help but upset. We have to find that release in our fiction where somebody's having to have a baby in an elevator, somebody's having to crawl on the roof of an elevator, or your elevator is descending into the Chinese hell where people are drowned alive. So,
you know, on that note, we should probably take a break.
Yes, we are going to take a quick break, I guess for like 30 seconds, and then when we come back, we will continue with elevators and to the planning that goes into them, and also the future of the elevator. What might that look like?
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, we're back. The elevator doors have opened, and we have arrived on the floor for our second half of this episode on elevators.
That's right. And in order for us to start talking more about the mathematical puzzle in earnest, we have to talk a little bit more about how our modern elevator system works. So one of the first things to know is that when you get into an elevator, it is automatically outfitted with load sensors in the floor. And that manages the amount of weight that's in the car. So if you've ever been in an overcrowded elevator and you hear the door dinging, it's because the sensor is saying, hey, man, someone's got to get off.
Yeah, and that's why elevator sensors and also hotel personnel can and will get visibly upset if people are jumping up and down an elevator.
Mm-hmm. Now, most elevator systems have a computer that logs a bunch of things, a bunch of, I will say, requests. These things that they log is where a person wants to go, where each floor is, and where the elevator car is in that time and space. So if you press a button for the floor you want to go to, the computer logs the request, and then the computer notes where a car is by either a magnetic sensor or a light sensor, and it's feeding all that information to itself in an algorithm. More advanced programs will take passenger traffic patterns into account. They know which floors have the highest demand and at what time of the day, and they direct the elevator cars accordingly, if you're lucky, if you're in the office building, right?
North Carrick Hall at UTK did not have kind of advanced system.
It did not. In a multiple car system, the elevator will direct individual cars based on the location of other cars. So all of that is going on in the background as soon as you press a button.
So it all leads to this big mathematical puzzle. It's, you know, how do you get from point A to point B? How do you get the cargo, the human cargo, from point A to point B with the least amount of issue without just totally clogging up the whole system, without angering the people that are working there, but also getting by with really maybe not the minimum, but a minimum amount of elevators, because elevators take up a lot of space. You need the shafts. You need the equipment rooms for them. And granted, certain technological advancements have cut down on the amount of equipment needed to run it. But for the most part, you're talking about a lot of space in a building. And space is valuable. Space is pricey. Remember, that's why we're building skyscrapers to begin with, because we want to maximize the amount of office that we can fit on a single piece of land. And if we end up filling up most of that with elevators, that kind of defeats the purpose.
It also kind of depends on the function of that building. That's something that a lot of engineers and mathematicians have to take into account. So if you look at something like the Bronx Family Court System, the building that that's housed in, and you look and back in 2007, you'll see that that whole court system was completely messed up. It was an absolute disarray because the elevators at its courthouse kept breaking down.
And you couldn't use the stairs.
Right.
It's not, and it wasn't like in our situation where the stairs are only for fire exits, so it's, you know, it's just not, they're not accessible. They shut off the stairwells because they were a safety risk. They were just like an escape from New York hellhole if you tried to take the stairs down to the Bronx.
Yeah, so if you had to go to the court, the courthouse in the Bronx in 2007, you were screwed because this led to hour-long waits, which led to missed court dates, which led to needless arrest warrants, and of course, just the general messing up of people's lives.
Yeah.
Now, this is something that mathematicians and engineers really want to try to avoid if they can. So they start to look at various probabilities, right? They've got probability tables that they rely on when they start to try to figure out this puzzle of elevator systems. So, for instance, if there are 10 people in an elevator that serves 10 floors, it will likely make 6.5 stops. You've got 10 people, 30 floors, then you've got 9.5 stops. This is somewhere they can start
from. Yeah, these are just the odds of traffic, yeah.
Now, there are two basic elevator metrics. One is handling capacity. So that's carrying a certain percentage of the building's population in 5 minutes. And by the way, 13% is ideal. So if you have, I don't know, 5,000 people in a building, then 13% of those 5,000 people should be serviced by your elevator system.
Yeah.
The other metric is the interval or the frequency of service. So the average round trip time of one elevator divided by the number of elevators. Okay. So now think of all the other factors, like door open and close time.
Yes.
Loading and unloading time. You guys out there who are looking at your smartphones or your Blackberries when you should be disembarking.
Right.
You know who you are.
You realize the last second you were supposed to get off, so then you make a dart through and stall everything out.
That's right. You're increasing the unloading time. Of
course,
I've
done that before. Or you have a situation where the thing is packed, and who needs to get off the elevator? The little old lady in the back of the car.
Yeah.
You know, so everyone has to sort of disembark, and they're a little wigged out because they're having to do this, and oh, what if they get stranded on the elevator? Because that's kind of a mild fear. If you get off on the wrong floor, you're going to have to take the elevator again to maybe to the bottom, depending on the system, and it's going to be a whole headache.
And you also have acceleration rate and deceleration rate, so when the elevator is stopping. And, of course, what we talked about before, interfloor traffic.
Yes.
Which is the thing that's sort of the wrench that you throw in that just kind of messes everything up.
Oh, and then to say nothing of phantom button pushers.
You know, that
is always the worst when it opens and there's nobody there. Where did they go? I guess in reality, there might have been another elevator coming up and someone got off on that floor and then they just hitched a ride on that one since it was there. But then my elevator arrives and it opens and you're just like, I guess it's the little girls from The Shining again.
Or the phantom farter.
I guess that is a thing. Yeah.
The phantom farter pushed the phantom floor.
Hmm. Because that is another unfortunate reality of elevators. Two people in an elevator, nobody is allowed to pass gas because it will be known who did it.
Yeah.
But three or more, people just feel like they have just an open license to just let it rip. And it's just an enclosed environment. So.
Well, and there's some people who do it on purpose.
Really? People like...
I know someone in my family, and I'm not going to mention. I told you, I have a very scatological family. Who they do this on purpose.
It's good to know.
Anyway, that is not, fortunately, a factor that mathematicians have to figure out, the actual farting capacity. but I did want to mention again the Otis elevator mathematician, Teresa Christie, because she developed algorithms using a computer simulation program, and that replays elevator decision-making. So she gets to see it in real time. And in that Wall Street Journal article called The Ups and Downs of Making Elevators Go, she says, I feel like I get paid to play video games. I watch the simulation, and I see what happens, and I try to improve the score I'm getting. Which is so cool. I love that, mm-hmm. that's part of her process. She's thinking about it that way. And she recently worked on the Empire State Building and was able to decrease the amount of time by, I think, 10 seconds, the time that they are actually in the elevator.
The history, you could, based on some of the material we were looking at, you could basically write a book just about the history of elevators in the Empire State Building, because they've been around for so long. You have some really catastrophic things happening from time to time, such as when the aircraft crashed into the Empire State Building and the impact severed the cables in one, perhaps two, of the elevators.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, you still had elevator operators, so they plummeted with those elevator operators on board. And I believe, I believe one operator was on board and one was not.
Mm-hmm.
And the one woman aboard the elevator ended up living, as I recall, because the cables were coiling up at the bottom of the elevator shaft as it plummeted, because it had to fall quite a distance. And by the time that it hit the bottom, it had a sort of cushion going. So she was really... She was badly injured, but she did survive.
And she was crouched in the corner, right?
Yes.
So that when the impact came at the bottom of the elevator, too, and kind of crumpled in the middle, she wasn't affected by that part. So, of course, we should say that elevators are really, really safe. I mean, the statistics on how safe they are will make you feel much better.
Otis will typically show you statistics that argue that they are safer than escalators. Because even though there are more elevators than escalators, the percentage of accidents is apparently higher with escalators. Likewise, most of the individuals who are injured or killed aboard elevators are people who are working on them. So they're in a heightened state of danger because they're on top of them or they're repairing broken elevators, etc.
Now, again, this is something that someone like Teresa Christie has to keep in mind when she's developing algorithms. And when she programs an elevator system, she also uses different weights for the average person by region. So, for instance, the average American is 22 pounds heavier than the average Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And she has to account for the way that people arrange themselves in an elevator, which turns out across cultures, it turns out that people will arrange themselves into various geometric patterns each time a new passenger gets on an elevator. So it seems very instinctive. So if you have two strangers on an elevator, they will gravitate to the back corners. A third person will stand by the door creating an isosceles triangle until a fourth person comes in, and then they'll spread out through all four corners, and then so on and so forth as people board.
Yeah, I believe that the article we were looking at, they used a dice as an example.
Yeah.
The position of the dots on any given side of a dice more or less illustrates how people position themselves on a crowded or less crowded elevator. And it's, similar to a lot of the rules that govern the bank of urinals in a men's room. Where is a man going to stand if there's no one at the urinals? Where will the second person to arrive stand? Where will the third, et cetera? Because no one wants to be too close to the, awkwardly close to the other individual who's taking a leak.
Yeah, I always wondered about that for you guys. That's got to be very bizarre. Someone just, like, if you're in there by yourself and someone just cruises up right next to you.
Yeah. If it's a long bank, like if it's a bank of, like a rest stop bank of like six urinals, it's a little weird if somebody stands right next to you. Now here at work, we just have two urinals. So it's, you're going to stand next to somebody and hopefully they won't talk to you.
I was going to say, is there chit chat?
Depends on the individual. Some people seem like they get a little nervous and they have to start talking and it's weird. But most people seem to be governed by the no talking while urinating.
I think that should be like the same set of rules for the elevator, right? Don't stand too close and don't chit-chat.
Yeah.
Really. All right. Teresa Christie, she is one of the premier engineers for Otis, mathematicians. She has created about 14 patents, and one of the patents I really love is called the surfboard feature.
Yes.
And I want the codes. This is something I wish that I was a great hacker, because I would hack in just to get the codes to elevators, because this feature allows you to essentially turn any elevator you're in into an express elevator.
Yeah, because the situation here is that in Hawaii, you have individuals who are taking the elevator, but they have a surfboard with them. So if they're on board with a surfboard, there's not room for anyone else really to get on board with them. They really need a direct line from their floor to the ground floor. And you know, this has a lot in common with, there are express elevators out there. For instance, really tall buildings. We mentioned the limits of elevators earlier. You can only build an elevator shaft so high, and then the physics get involved and they prohibit anything else. So you'll have a landing platform, like mm-hmm. halfway up the skyscraper, and you take an express elevator to that, and then you wait on an elevator to elevators to service the higher floors. So the idea of an express elevator isn't new, but what this is doing is creating a custom express elevator for privileged guests, for surfers.
Yeah, and you know what? This is one little odd tidbit that I wanted to throw out there that we did not talk about, and it's a type of elevator system called the destination dispatch, in which you key your floor number into a pad in the lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And the computer then tracks where the cars are and assigns you an elevator bank number.
Right. So these are the ones you go in, and then there are no buttons.
No buttons whatsoever. So the illusion is just shattered. You have no control. You're in an elevator that you cannot manipulate in any way.
Yeah, I believe Palmgarten was the one who compared those elevators to like an elevator in a Bond villain's mansion or something. You know, you're on board and you're like, who's in charge? Is this going to open up, you know, into a pit of sharks or something? I don't know. I'm totally out of control. And again, it comes back to the idea that our technology, narrative of elevators
mm-hmm.
is giving us power and then steadily taking it away. It's interesting to behold.
How it dovetails with whatever else is going on in the world of technology. I wanted to point out that jumping just before impact, this is something that you hear about sometimes, like, oh, if an elevator crashes, you can jump just before impact mm-hmm. and you'll be fine. That's a myth.
Yeah.
I want to close it out with that, because
there's never any reason to jump on an elevator.
Never, right. As you say, that'll mess up the weight sensors. And there's two problems with that scenario. You can't jump fast enough to counteract the speed of falling. That's the first problem. And you wouldn't really know when to jump, right?
Yeah, exactly. I believe James Fortune, when asked about this in Palmgarten's article, he just said, well, dead is dead. he's kind of a grim individual. He'd been in the elevator business a long time, had a very... very straightforward outlook on these.
He'd been in so many elevators, he had been thinking about being entombed for a while, I suppose.
So the future of elevators. This is, of course, a fascinating... We end up getting here in most of our podcasts. What does this mean for the future?
Mm-hmm.
How will this change in the future? And a number of these technologies we've talked about, I mean, that is the future. The idea that we're going to see more and more elevators where we have less and less control. It's all in the computers. There are no buttons. Maybe they have some buttons, but it's just about giving us a false sense of power. Also, smaller engines, better cables, sort of technological increases in small areas that improve and sort of whittle down and perfect the existing product. But as far as rapid changes, as far as like really game-changing
mm-hmm.
changes, it's less certain in that area. Because instantly, when you think of high-tech, crazy, fantastic elevators, you probably think of two things. You probably think of the elevators in the starships in Star Trek,
mm-hmm.
which could move just about anywhere inside the ship, horizontal, vertically. Likewise, I think you see those in the recent Total Recall movie. They're elevator boxes that move up and down and sideways. And, of course, the Wonkavator
mm-hmm.
that can go sideways and diagonal ways and just can fly, and it's glass, and it's the most marvelous thing ever. Now, Otis did have a design. They were working on it in the late 90s, and it was called the Odyssey. And they had a prototype for this as well. And this is essentially an elevator that can travel horizontally and vertically. So instead of having to take that express elevator up and then get off and then board some more elevators, you would have an elevator that could climb halfway up the building, then move horizontally into another elevator shaft, and then climb that one.
Yeah.
So it was a really I mean, everyone there was really excited about it, and it was going to be huge. But then the 1997 Asian financial crisis hit. There was a rising cost of electricity, and it basically, the idea was scrapped, or at least put on the back shelf to maybe be picked up later on. But as Palmgarten points out in his article, one of the things is that the elevator essentially, in most people's minds, is already perfect. I mean, it's not perfect. There, you know, we want things, we want the 30 seconds or less, and the faster it gets, obviously, the better. But for the most part, nobody is demanding these crazy changes.
Well, yeah, necessity being the mother of invention. So until buildings really start to get more, I guess, horizontal and vertically oriented, we probably won't see elevators change that much.
Now, I do want to add, though, that there are pressurized elevators now. In at least one of the high rises in Dubai, I believe. So you are seeing that technological change take place, and that's kind of futuristic. The idea that the elevator is pressurized like a spaceship, but for the most part, don't expect the Wonkavator to be available in your area just yet.
That's right. Now, if you are a gearhead and you want to have a bit of a deeper dive into more elevator specifics, including hydraulic systems versus, say, roped systems, check out How Elevators Work by Tom Harris. That's on HowStuffWorks.com. It's a great article that will take you through every different aspect mechanically of elevators. And I have a little quote to take us out. All right. And if the elevator tries to bring you down, go crazy. Punch a higher floor. Ding, ding, ding. Ding, ding,
who's
ding.
Who's that a quote from?
Prince Rogers Nelson.
Oh, I don't know that song. Song?
And then if the elevator tries to bring you down.
Oh, okay.
Go crazy. No? All right.
I'm sure many listeners will know what you're talking about. So that's good. I like the quote. I like the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, hey, we're going to skip our listener mail since we went a bit long on this one. And goodness, we could have probably kept going there because we ended up getting so many cool facts about elevators. We didn't even get into some of the crazy things people do on elevators. The ice cream story that I think you've shared before.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Your father was on an elevator with an ice cream cone?
Yeah, he was in his office building, and the woman next to him said, that looks really good. And he said, it is. And she leaned over and took a big bite out of it, and then the doors opened and she got off.
And then you said that you yourself have at times danced on elevators? Did you say this?
I've done a lot of singing.
Yeah.
We probably shouldn't talk about that.
Well, we would love to hear our listeners talk about that. So if you have some insight into elevators, elevator culture, elevator design, we would love to hear about it. Particularly, what's the craziest elevator you've ever been on? Be it super high-tech or crazy archaic? What's your favorite scene with an elevator from a movie or TV show? Be it something realistic or just completely unrealistic. And what do you think about your interactions on an elevator? Has someone ever taken a bite of your ice cream? Do you dance or sing? How do you interact with strangers or pseudo-work strangers when you're aboard an elevator? We'd love to hear from everyone about these questions. So you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Tumblr. We are Stuff to Blow Your Mind on both of those. And we're also on Twitter, where our handle is Blow the Mind.
And if you are the ice cream bandit and you want to confess, you can write us at blowthemind@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.